Author of the Week, featuring another great creator of narratives for the human race on Southside Broadcasting and Siren Radio.
The Sino-Nippon War is over. It's the year 2113, and Japan is crushed under the might of Chinese Allied forces. A former Coalition Corps soldier, U.S. Marine Balam Hendricks, is now a feared bounty hunter known as the Reverend. Sounds interesting? Well, it's going to get even more interesting because we have the creator of this newest dystopian cyberpunk novella with us for our Author of the Week feature. That's Keith Anthony Baird. How are you, Keith?
I'm very good. How are you?
Great. Well, great to connect with you, good self. And I think for once, we're not actually going across the Atlantic Ocean. Whereabouts are we? Because I'm connecting with you today.
Yeah, you're only going as far as Cumbria because I'm based in the Lake District. So,
yeah. Cumbria is a strange world, Keith, as Beatrix Potter said many years ago. So, you know, on that side of things, it's a whole new side of things. Let's jump straight in to the world of Synthetica. S-I-N, of course, colon, Thetica. See what you did there. Talk to us about why this was something which appealed to your good self and indeed why it's really could well be the launch of a whole new universe.
Well, I'm a dark fiction author. I don't kind of limit myself to sort of one thing. I mean, a lot of authors will only sort of concentrate on horror, or they will do kind of like psychological thrillers. Whereas for me myself, I like to do anything that comes under that kind of umbrella of dark fiction. So it may well be post-apocalyptic. It could be a psychological thriller. It could be a horror. It could be dark sci-fi. So what I like to do as well is I like to do genre mashups. So I like to put elements of different things in, whether there's kind of like a psychological element to the story, whether there's some technology, whether there's, you know, sort of dark supernatural element to it. It could be dark fantasy. So I just basically try to mash up all of those different elements, ingredients. And Synthetica, in a way, is very much like that. I mean, yes, it's dystopian, and obviously, you know, the kind of subgenre of that is cyberpunk. But there's lots of other things going on because it's kind of a hard story to sell to people without actually giving a lot away. So I have to be very careful in how I sort of explain.
We don't want any spoilers, Keith. We want to ease away from the spoilers.
It's,
so that's
it's
that's
really,
okay.
Really hard as well because It's kind of like a story within a story. So in order to not sort of give that away, there's only a certain amount of things I can say. I mean, you basically introduced it there with this sort of rough premise of it. But what the guy is he's an ex-Marine. He's a US Marine who's kind of savagely damaged in war towards the end of the conflict. And what you have is a kind of futuristic setting where it's kind of a massive shift. So you're talking 2097 is when this war is happening. So there's been a huge shift in the sort of geopolitical landscape between now and then. You actually have a situation where you have the likes of the UK, the USA, France, so on and so forth, are actually in alliance with China against Japan, because kind of like if a reflection of history, when Japan rose up in the Second World War to become, you know, sort of aligned with Germany in a sense. So you have that kind of situation again. I mean, it's completely fanciful because, I mean, that kind of thing probably isn't ever going to happen. But what I wanted to do was I wanted to kind of like shift things around completely rather than people think, well, you know, the kind of obvious enemies tend to be Russia or North Korea but I wanted to sort of mix that up. I wanted to say, well, no, actually something very different could happen. Mm-hmm. So he basically goes off to war in a coalition corps. So it's made up of all troops from different nationalities. And they're fighting the sort of final exchanges of the war in Tokyo. So it's kind of like the last battle for the big city. And he basically a particle round hits the troop transporter that he's in, he gets blown out of it. And then right, okay. So then it cuts to he wants to stay after the war in New Tokyo, which is under Chinese rule. And the city's rebuilt, but basically it's like a dystopian city. It's a very futuristic city. Then it then cuts to 2113. So he's had a new life established in this city where he's become a feared bounty hunter called the Reverend. And the reason he's called the Reverend is because he does not bring people in. Every assignment he gets, it's kind of like a kill mission. So he's up to about sort of nearly 100 kills by this point. So I call him the Reverend because basically it's if I meet you, I'll be giving you your last rites, you know. So that's what he is. He's so feared. He's kind of this, I don't know how to describe it, like a real concrete badass, basically.
A
Obviously,
rogue
he's kind of
trooper for the 22nd century.
yes, you've hit the nail on the head there. I mean, Rogue Trooper is a really good sort of sort of reference for that. A lot of people who've read it so far, the early arcs and everything, have said, oh, we kind of see him as kind of like Judge Dredd sort of thing, you know. So he's very much like that. So it's very deadpan. There's one-liners. You're talking about a guy who, you know, he's so jaded. He's heard everybody's line of nonsense, you know what I mean? So he's not prepared to put up with anything anymore. So he's just the badass who's got that reputation in New Tokyo. And he basically accepts a job. Now, his jobs, like I pointed out, he usually just takes people out. But he's accepted a job from a known crime lord called Vargas, who's basically a total, you know, he's like a sewer rat. He's king of the sewers there, basically. And he accepts a job, but he knows that he's playing with fire. He knows that, you know, he's been given this mission, but he has to figure out really what's going on because he knows that it's not the real mission. So he basically, what he has to do is he has to go to this corporation called V-Trans Industries, and that's in the French Quarter. And what they do is they offer Synthetica is advertised in big neon all over the city, and he's just basically never really been interested in it because he's not interested in that kind of thing, that sort of high tech world. He has high tech gadgets, and security and weaponry, but he's never been interested in kind of escaping from that reality. And that's what Synthetica is. The corporation offers it to people to escape from their day-to-day reality so they can live a better life in like full immersion. But the crime lord says, well, the guy, the rogue employee I want you to track down has gone into Synthetica. So you're going to have to go cyber side. You're going to have to go into immersion in a pod. You won't have your weapons like on you physically. You have to go in there with your mind and you have to find this guy and be more like a detective. So initially, he doesn't want to do it because it's not the kind of thing that he does. But it's going to give him like a huge payday, you know. And he's getting older and he thinks, you know, I don't have a retirement plan. I need the money. So he accepts the job. And basically, it's all kind of deception. So there's kind of like different stories going on within it all. And then ultimately, without giving too much away, it's kind of like, you think one thing's going on, you think another thing's going on, but like really something else entirely is going on. So it's got all these different layers within it. And I had to kind of like figure out, like, so if you think like a film like The Matrix, where you're kind of immersed into something and it's given you a version of reality. Well, Synthetica is kind of like a version of reality within a version of reality. So it's kind of very complex. So without giving the game away, I won't spoil what happens to the guy
No,
in the end. Yeah, it's a very complex. I called it a digital onion in an interview I did the other day, because it has many layers, and it was kind of figuring out how that all works together was kind of like the challenge of it. So yeah,
Very
complex film.
rewarding, of course. And I wonder if Philip K. Dick, or indeed William Gibson or Bruce Sterling, actually realized what the legacy would actually be. Obviously,
Absolutely.
Gibson's still writing from that point of view, but we go on regardless. And let us not even start about Three Body Problem and Su
I
Xin
just
Liu.
started watching that the other day. It's that's an interesting one as well.
So, Anna, clearly lots of material there to focus on from the Romanian perspective. Any questions you'd like to put to Keith?
I have so many questions with so little time. So I'm just going to start by saying real fast, it sounds fascinating, everything that you said. And also, I really like your accent. My first question is, so how did you start write? You said that you started writing dark fiction about 2016. How did you start writing that? And also, you were at first a self-published author. When you first started writing your first novel, your first book, did you ever think about becoming this big and ha writing so many other books and stories?
Those are good questions. I mean, I'd always been in publishing in some way. I mean, I'm 54 now, okay? But when I was 24, I started my own magazine. And it was only ever meant to be a regional thing. And that was in the north of the UK. And I'd sort of put in place my own distribution network when I'd set it up. I wrote a business plan, got all the finance in place. And it was going to be put in record stores and cafes and various places throughout the Northeast. But what happened was I managed to get it on national TV. I got some exposure for it. And what happened there was a company down in East Sussex called Diamond Distribution. They got in touch with me and they said, if you put a bit more money into this, we can take it national for you. Now, it was kind of like a huge step. So I'd been sort of trading for 6 months on a local level, and then I was suddenly going national. So I was down to London all the time, and inevitably I was too young. I was only 24, so and it was too much to handle, you know. So eventually the printers pulled out on the contract, the whole thing collapsed, and then I went into newspapers as a and I worked my way up to being a senior sub-editor in my late 20s, and then after that I became the publishing editor for a national web-based company. So I'd always been editing other people's writing, yeah. But I had this idea when I was 19 years old. I would imagine that's somewhere near your age now, yeah. I had this idea of my first novel, and it was like it was all in there. All of it was in my head. I knew the ending. I knew everything. Kind of like maybe the middle, I didn't really know, but I knew how I wanted it to sort of transpire. So, but because my life had gone in lots of different directions. I didn't really sort of sit down until about age 45, pushing 46, where I'd done a lot of things. You know, I'd done the things that I've told you about in publishing, and I'd ran people's businesses for them. So I'd always been very, very busy, and I'd never really had the time to do it. So at that point, my life had changed. I moved over to the northwest of the country, and it's a little bit more peaceful and less sort of busy over here. And it's very inspiring for writing as well, because you know the mountains and the lakes are beautiful and everything. So then I decided, right, I'm going to sit down and I'm going to do this. And I was working full time at the time, so it was really hard to do that because I had to do it at evenings and do some of it on the weekends. So it took me about 16 months to write it. But I mean, it's like I've said to a lot of people, that was the first piece of fiction I ever did. It was called The Jesus Man, which was a post-apocalyptic horror novel. And it's kind of like set at the end of the world after we've kind of annihilated everything. But it has a deeply religious theme. So if you think of kind of like The Exorcist or The Omen, and you kind of mix that with like Mad Max, you've kind of got like that scenario. Yeah. And but it was 105,000 words. So the first bit of dark fiction that I wrote was that big. Instead of just a lot of people start very small, but for me, I just dove in the ocean, basically. But it was because I had that big story in my head; it had always been there. So I self-published that one via Amazon, and then I put it out as an audiobook as well via Audible. And then stupidly, I wrote another huge novel straight afterwards. So I went and did another 104,000 word novel called Nexalexicon, which is a bit of a cosmic horror novel with a historic timeline. So that's about the first 3 years of my writing was those two novels. And then I did a book of short stories. Then I put a couple of anthologies and invited other authors to come and be involved in those. And then I did a couple of novelettes. And then after about 5 years, I kind of got to the point where I sort of said, well, I've done all of this on my own. And no man's an island, and it's really hard to get any further without any help. So my partner at the time, Anne, she said to me, why don't you send your work to publishers? And I'd been very sort of against that in the first 5 years because I guess because I was an editor, I sort of thought to myself, well, I can handle all of my own editing. And I'd been a graphic designer, so I designed the covers and all the rest of it. So I had all those skills. I thought, well, I don't really need anybody else's involvement. But the involvement I did need was to get into a big distribution chain and to get publicity and all the rest of it. So yes, I sent off a novella, a dark fantasy novella. I sent that off to various publishers, and I got two publishers interested. Both of them were in the United States. One was in Arizona, and one was in Kansas. And subsequently, the one in Kansas sent what I thought was a much better, more comprehensive contract. So I went with Bridget's Gate Press in Kansas, and they put out that novella in November 22, which is called The Grim Dark Strands of the Spinneret. And then they're putting out Synthetica in May. And they're also putting out another novella that I wrote in conjunction with another British author called Beverly Lee, which is called A Light of Little Radiance. And that's a vampire novel. That's coming out in November this year as well. So, basically, if I hadn't have taken that plunge, if I hadn't have decided to go with a publisher, those three books, I would probably have struggled to get those out. I may have had to go down the self-publishing route again. So basically, BGP have been very supportive of me. They've assigned me a publicist, a guy called Mickey Mickelson in Texas. And he's getting me various engagements, like radio in America and, this one here today, and lots of podcasts, lots of magazine interviews, various articles, features, columns. So it's all starting to sort of ramp up. It's taking off a little bit more now. So there you go.
And being from this world, were you ever afraid of other editors and their opinions on what you're writing or other publishers?
I was initially, I think, which is why it kind of governed my sort of self-publishing route. But once I made the plunge to send my work off to publishers, and sometimes they use in-house staff or they use outside freelancers. But I didn't really find any of the kind of like editing was particularly heavy. It was more a case of, can you just explain this more? Can you put a bit more context in place in the body of your work? Because as the first time reader of this, I'm not fully understanding it or whatever. So it wasn't really heavy editing, to be honest with you. It was more sort of streamlining, more what I would term revision more than anything else. So no, I mean, initially it was a stumbling block, but once I'd taken the plunge to go with publishers, I was totally fine about it. Absolutely.
There's always the classic case of escaping the slush pile, which is a whole new series wanting to be developed, basically.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, the thing about it as well is, I mean, you can go two routes, can't you? You can, when publishers have an open call, they'll say, even if you don't have an agent, we'll take your manuscript. But like you say, it ends up in a slush pile of so many. I mean, sometimes those open calls, you'll see a publisher go on social media and they'll say, oh, we've had 1,000 submissions. And they're only looking to publish one or two books out of all of that. And you think to yourself, well, the numbers are just crazy here, And it's the same when you're querying in the trenches with an agent, when you're trying to get an agent. An agent is just being bombarded with manuscripts. So, I mean, obviously, they just see samples at first, generally, and then they ask for a full manuscript. But it's kind of, I mean, the way I look at it is this: I'm in the 1% game. It's as simple as that. I'm going to get 1% acceptance, and I'm going to get 99% told they don't want my work. And that's just the way it is. I think when you go into publishing, you've got to be armor plated. You have to, because there's so much in the way of rejection. But I mean, the way I look at it is this: is if you think about it, actors are in the same position. They go for tons and tons of casting calls, and they just don't get picked for projects. Somebody else gets the gig, and the same with directors, or producers when they're wanting to get a.
Actually, it's pretty much the same for the entire creative arts industry, Keith, but that's
Absolutely.
a different line. Let's talk inspirations. Let's talk influencers, because as we've already mentioned, some writers who clearly do have a lot of influence in terms of where they've developed their stuff. We can go back even further to the likes of Edgar Allan Poe, to Wells, to Jules Verne, and so on. Clearly, we've got a whole tranche of 20th century writing where, in many cases, we say, well, it's all very well, Keith, saying it's science fiction, but actually, we're living in a science fiction world, effectively. So, the very nature of this interview is being conducted in a mechanism which probably 30 years ago would have been seen as pure science fiction. Who influences yourself, Keith, in terms of which authors? I mean, we cited obviously some 2000 AD classics back in the day. You come obviously from the land that gave Simon Donald, of course, Viz, not necessarily dystopian, but obviously a fairly successful take on the world and publishing, etc. Any particular sort of influences you've had which you think, yeah, actually, if it hadn't been for that particular Anne McCaffrey novel or Ursula K. Le Guin or that particular writer, this is what really turned me on to science fiction and indeed horror as a genre, as opposed to becoming a romantic fiction writer?
Well, I mean, all of the aforementioned that you mentioned there certainly have been influential. Obviously, for horror, I mean, in my teens, what I did was I spent a lot of time reading Poe and Lovecraft, that kind of thing. But what I also did was it got me kind of interested in, it got me also interested in sort of things like pagan sort of religion and things like that. I mean, not that I wanted to embrace that, but I sort of read a lot of mythology and studied the sort of cultures of the world as well. So it kind of branched me into all of that. So like when you get into all of that, you get all of their kind of lore, and their spiritual beliefs, and different kind of entities that they believe in. So there was all of that as well. And then of course there was a science fiction side of things that because anything that was kind of dark was kind of interesting to me. I mean, I wasn't like a morbid kid or anything like that. I wasn't. It was just, I think it
You mean
was
you
kind
didn't
of like
sleep in a coffin, Keith? You surprised me. Tyra Wilcox did.
no, and I'm trying to stay out of one at this point in my life. So no, but it was just for me, it was just pure escapism. I mean, the thing about it as well is it wasn't just reading books. There was a lot of that. And I had quite a sizable book collection for a teenager. I really did. I had a small room, but it was just there was books everywhere, but I think probably the thing for me which cemented kind of my love of horror and sci-fi together, was there was a guy up the road from me. Now, we're going back when I was about 13 years old, okay? And he was like an only child. And his mum bought him lots and lots of things. So anything that came out, he got. Okay. So he got a colour TV for his bedroom. He got a VCR when VCRs were just totally new on the planet, And we had a local video store where we could go and hire movies. Yeah. And what he would do is he would always convince his mother. Now he was like a year younger than me, he was only 12, but he would convince his mother to go and get the 18 rated films out from there, and then we would sit at the ages of 12 and 13 and we'd watch things like John Carpenter's The Thing and Halloween and all this kind of stuff. So I'd sit there and watch that, and I wasn't kind of like terrified by it. I was kind of like mystified by it, and I loved it. And I always quote John Carpenter's The Thing as being the thing for me, which kind of cemented my love of sci-fi and horror together.
And not the Howard
So,
Hawks directed version, The Thing from Another World's the
no,
original back in
Carpenter looks like a
1951.
guy. He doesn't really look like anything sort of scary, really. but I mean, I know the whole thing was kind of a reboot of all of that. And they're talking about redoing it again. I think they should just leave it alone, but that's whatever. So I mean, it wasn't really just books. It was the visuals. And for me, what I try and do, I mean, people who've read my stuff and have left reviews or whatever say that they felt like they were immersed in a movie. Like they could see it all in their head, in their mind's eye. They could see that, and I think that's what I've always tried to do with my writing. I've always tried to make it quite cinematic, in that sense. And I think that's probably born from that, to be honest. Those days curled up watching those movies when I shouldn't really have been doing that. I should have been doing homework or something.
And the world of computer games, of course, which is very much around us all these days and arguably much more successful than Hollywood in terms of bang per buck, shall we say. Is that something which you think the some of your worlds could actually be adapted to? I mean, I'm thinking about, obviously, you said audio versions and so on. Would you actually take the notion of seeing some of the material, New Tokyo, for instance, in a kind of cyber world, another cyber world, a gaming world.
I mean, that's an interesting question because when I put this together, I kind of thought myself it would lend itself cinematically, definitely, as maybe like a standalone thing, but it could actually be serialized without if you take the ending away, you could serialize it, you could put it into a game, so he could have lots more missions, he could have he could explore that world a lot more. There could be a lot more world building. And the thing about sci-fi is that a lot of readers or anybody who's immersed in that kind of world, whether it be via gaming, they like a lot of world building. So with Synthetica only being a novella of roughly 40,000 words, the challenge I had, I guess, was to make enough world building in that for it to be appealing to a sci-fi fan. Because really, it's just a snapshot of a guy who's on a mission that lasts 2 to 3 days maximum, so it was a challenge to kind of shoehorn enough world building into it to make it work. But definitely I could see it working as a game easily.
Well, I mean,
Or even a VR thing in itself. That would be interesting. A VR experience in itself would be really good.
I'm still recovering from the shock that Sonic the Hedgehog lost out most iconic position in video games to Lara Croft, but that was a recent sort of announcement there. So why not the Reverend, who could actually sort of take on board a whole new line there? Anyway, speaking of science fiction, in a few weeks' time, Anna will be joining us on a location report for, I think, her first ever science fiction convention at Sci-Fi Scarborough. Do like to geek beside the seaside. Are you an attendee of science fiction conventions? I mean, because it is often a place for writers to effectively connect with their author, connect with their readership, connect with their potential audience, and so on. Is it an area that you'd like to consider, or is it a case of no, I like to stay well away from those human beings?
Well, I've done a few in the past. I did them under my own steam when I was self-publishing. But the thing of it was what I found then was I just wasn't well known enough. And yes, you can go and you can speak to a lot of people, but I think they were kind of like, well, we don't really know who you are yet. So they were a bit
So buy a
reticent.
book and find out.
Well, yes, that's what I tried to convince them, but it worked to a degree. But I think probably what will happen is, say for instance, Synthetica blooms or A Light of Little Radiance blooms in terms of sales. I think that what there's definitely more conventions happening in the States. I mean, they're going on all the time. And I think a possibility would be that my publisher would say, look, you've had very great sales over here. We'll get you over to some conventions and we'll snowball that. I think in the UK, because my publicist is based in Texas, most of my publicity, if you like, has been stateside until very recently. I've done a few engagements in the UK, and this is one of them. But I really need more things to happen in the UK. I mean, one of the things I'm going to do, I mean, you could go to Waterstones, for instance, and because they're supplied by the main UK distributor here is called Gardeners in the wholesale side of things, and you can order any of my books from Gardeners, but Waterstones have each individual boss, if you like, of each store, and they make the buying in decisions. So you can't actually walk into a Waterstones now and pick one of my books off a shelf, unless they got lots of people walking in and were asking for it. Then they would decide to stock it. Yeah. So what I'm going to do with Synthetica is I'm going to approach Forbidden Planet. So ask them to see if they want to take it in from Gardeners, because it's perfect for sci-fi, and that's what they do. So I'm trying to get more of a foothold in the UK, because I'm just more well known in the States. I mean, I'm getting requests now from authors over in the States if I would blurb their books for them. So they're obviously, they obviously consider me to be a bit more well known there than I am here. And it's kind of strange. I almost feel like I'm in a 1970s punk band that has to go to Japan in order to get big. You know what I mean?
Well,
Like, yeah, go outside your own country in order to make it, and then sort of come back, kind of thing. That's the way I feel. So conventions at the moment, what you have to consider is you have to buy a table, so there's a cost in that. You have to invest in the stock that you're going to take. You have to invest in banners, to jazz up your whole table. Yeah, and then usually it goes on over a weekend, so you've got to find a hotel to pay for as well. So, I mean, you're probably looking just to go and do something like that as an author. You've got to spend about £500, £500, £600, something like that. And then you've got to say to yourself, am I going to sell enough books to recoup that? So sometimes it's a gamble.
It's
And what happened? Yeah.
all part of the
And what
fun
happened
and the
when I
joy.
initially did it, it wasn't financially viable for me then. I think what I'd like to do is gauge it. And like I say, if the sales get big enough, then I think the demand will be big enough, so then it'll work, But at this point in time, it just isn't financially viable for me to do it.
One of our regular contributors is the award-winning writer George Mann, and George often likes to branch out into a number of key areas. Obviously, he created Arty and Hobbs. He's written, of course, for Doctor Who. He's written for Star Wars, the Star Wars universe, and so on. Are there any particular areas or particular aspects or characters in the wide world of science fiction and fantasy that you thought, actually, I'd love to get my hands on the latest Fantastic Four scenario? I've got a great thing for them to put forward, or I could do something for Deadpool, which would make Wolverine versus Deadpool just mild by comparison.
That is a really good question. I mean, my mind doesn't generally go to that kind of thing, I'll be honest with you, because I kind of think to myself that's almost kind of like a realm where if you've got an agent, yeah, you can get those kind of gigs. And I think if you're an author and you're unagented, then I think you probably would struggle on that front, I mean, I'd love to do some 2000 AD stuff. If that was kind of like put into book form, I would love to do, like you say, Rogue Trooper or Dread or something like that. I think that would be fantastic. I'd like to do something with the Alien franchise, because that's always open for the possibility of that as well. But I mean, I think for me, I think where I would really like to see my work go is more streaming. I'd like to see something taken that I've written. I'd like to see that adapted for the screen. That's where I would really like to go. But I mean, again, that's agent territory. You need to have an agent in order to do that,
Well, we've already
So.
spoken about three body problem, which perhaps some people would say the Netflix version is far inferior to the original Chinese version, but so it goes. Anna, any closing questions or thoughts from yourself?
I do have many questions, but we again don't have much time left. I just want to ask you real quick. So I was wondering, for someone that wants to write dark fiction or dark novels, what is the structure of a dark novel?
Structure of a dark novel. I mean, well, It's kind of
For
anything.
example, for romance, you have the meet cute, the midpoint crisis, you have the road back to each other and stuff. What are these points in the dark fiction or dark novels?
Well, I mean, for me, it's never been a case of like I have this certain structure, or there is a certain structure that I'm going to follow. I mean, you probably, I'll be honest with you, Annie, you're probably asking the wrong author for that, because what I try and do is I try and do things which are completely out of the box. Yeah. So if you've got your literary sandbox there, like I'm going to do something which is going to just completely turn it on its head, because I just don't follow any kind of formulas or anything like that. I mean, I'm one of those authors, I think you're either going to love what I do or you're just going to hate what I do, and you're not going to be anywhere in the middle,
It's like
you
an
know.
onion. When you peel it, it can make you cry. But maybe
We're
that's
back
part of
to
the whole intention.
the onion again. Yeah, I mean, but you know, they always say the best kind of art polarizes opinion. You know, so I always kind of aim for that. So I don't give kind of like the literary happy meal that people are expecting. You know, if they go, this is my formula, and I always read things that are in that formula, I would say, don't read my books then, because I'm just not in that formula at all, you
And
know.
Keith, you've
So,
made some wonderful points there. Synthetica, of course, is out now. Later on in the year, of course, Light of Little Radiance should well be developing. You can be contacted, I believe, Keith, via going to the simple line at KAB author, both on Instagram and X.
absolutely. And if you want to get Synthetica cheap, get it now, because my publisher's got it on cheap for 78p in the UK, all the way up until May 21st. And after that, it'll be more expensive. So I'd grab it now if I was you.
Excellent. Well, it's been delightful connecting with your good self. We've got two final questions for your good self. Have you had a reasonably interesting Zoomer with us today on your midweek drive debut? Has it been good for you?
Absolutely. Unbelievable.
Excellent. Well, there you go. I mean, we like to feel that Cumbria can connect with Lincoln, both in Nebraska and in Lincoln, England. It's just part and parcel of the whole thing. So we take it then you'd be kind enough to return sometime?
I would love to come back. Absolutely. Light of Little Radiance, have me back. We'll chat about that one. Yeah.
Keith Anthony Baird, creator of The Onion and more in cyberspace. We thank you. Take care.
Wonderful. Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
Now, we've spoken a lot already this month about the challenge of PTSD. We've had March for March, a whole range of other aspects in terms of fundraising and so on. But what about the whole notion of the NHS in general? How can it actually help in terms of this? Well, they are actually raising awareness with respect to a project called Operation Courage for the Veterans Mental Health and Wellbeing Service. And to talk about this, we're delighted to welcome NHS England Associate Medical Director for the Armed Service Forces and Veterans Health. That's Dr. Jonathan Leach, OBE. Jonathan, welcome. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you very much for inviting me.
Well, great to connect with your good self, but certainly this whole notion of mental health and well-being, something which thankfully we have progressed as a civilization substantially since what 110 years ago, people who actually suffered trauma in the battlefield were basically just regarded as deserters, possibly, and even sort of executed. So we've made progress, but do we still have a long way to go?
Yeah, I think we do. I think particularly with regard to the military community, and obviously there are many members of particularly the Air Force who have settled in your area, is the vast majority of veterans are absolutely fine. And I think that's an important point. Actually, as they leave the services, they bring range of skills, experiences, work ethic, which can be really positive to employers. And I think that is a really important point. But within that, we know that there are significant numbers who have mental health difficulties. So what we've been trying to do, particularly through What Courage and some of the other initiatives, is actually provide a very specific and more dedicated service for military veterans, so that, for example, they are assessed and seen by people who have an understanding of the military. One of the things we hear regularly is people don't come forward because, firstly, the stigma around mental health, and that's obviously, as you described, still in society, but is better than it used to be, I agree. But also for the military community, there are additional ones. I'm not going to see this civvy. They won't understand me. They won't understand what I've seen. They won't understand my culture. So actually, Op Courage provides that. And that you would get seen and assessed by people who have a deep understanding of the needs of the military. And what's so important with that is that you then get people with you can trust. Because trust is really important in terms of being able to have that therapeutic relationship with people who understand you. And the other thing about this is the fact that when we designed Op Courage, you do not need a GP referral. And that's absolutely deliberate. We don't want barriers. We would rather people come forward earlier. And this is before, as an example, people might turn to alcohol or drugs, go downtown, get a criminal conviction, things like this. So actually intervening earlier, so keeping those barriers as low as possible is really important. So you can self-refer. And in fact, the data shows that of about the 30,000 we've had through Op Courage over recent years, about 60% are referrals by a loved one, such as a partner or family member, or alternatively by charities such as Help for Heroes or RAF Benevolent Fund, things like this. So really important that people understand that these services are available, they're tailored, and to come forward earlier rather than later.
Jonathan, you've provided a very lucid and very effective summation of the situation with respect to Op Courage. Is it all fundamentally down to that communication, actually having the courage, quite literally, to say, look, I'm having difficulty. I need to actually basically discuss my challenges?
Yeah, so it's called Op Courage. Actually, that was a name by the veterans as part of our very active patient participation group. And they recognized that it takes courage to come forward. And so it was their name and it was their choice, which I agree with, which is the reason why it's called that. And it's really important that people come forward. And then in parallel with the Op Courage, we've also got Op to Restore, which actually looks at physical health. And then we've been rolling out, for example, GP accredited surgeries, whereby we have maybe a GP lead. So if I just use a clinical example, the gentleman thinking of actually was in the RAF. He sadly saw his best friend killed in Afghanistan, had PTSD from that, and also had intractable pain from other injuries that he endured. So actually, I, as a part of a veteran accredited practice, referred him into What Courage. So he had specific dedicated mental health support for that, but also had specific dedicated help for his physical problems. And actually treating the two in parallel was really important. And he's now so much better. And I think that's a testament to what we're trying to do.
Looking at the long-term prognosis, would you say that actually we are in a better state dealing with issues such as this, or do we still have a long way to go?
I think we are in a better place. I think there is still a lot of stigma. We also know that sadly, a number of veterans take their life. We've been doing a lot of work regarding, what we can do to help and support. I come from a perspective that every sad loss of somebody is avoidable. And so we certainly need to do more work there, and we're doing that. As an example, I've been involved with somebody over this last weekend who sadly tried to take his life last week. He's in hospital receiving support and treatment, and then Op Courage will actually reach into the hospital and, as he's discharged, support him as he's been discharged. So yes, we have more to do there. I think also I said at the beginning that the vast majority of veterans are absolutely fine. I gave a talk to a local council, and I said one of the key things actually is understanding that the vast majorities of veterans are absolutely fine. They bring these skills, give them a job, these social determinants, so that actually you get, you have a job, you have an income, you have a roof over your head, are really important in terms of the overall mental health and also physical health of anybody, but specifically veterans.
You may not be able to answer this without any data, but how does England compare with other countries when it comes to military services? I mean, thinking obviously we have a series, sadly, of global conflicts going on. Are there any indications that there are international support structures for veterans in other areas and other countries?
Yeah, actually, it's a good question. We regularly discuss things with our international partners, particularly those with English language. So, for example, I was recently on a meeting with Australian government representatives, similarly, previously with Canadian. Actually, they're looking at what we're doing. We gave evidence to a Royal Australian Royal Commission. They've got a particular issue regarding Australian veterans who sadly take their life, and they're doing a lot of work there. But actually, they came across only a few months ago, and they were looking not just in this country but elsewhere about how they can organise their veteran services better to support people, and particularly to avoid some of these complete tragedies. And they were particularly impressed with what we've been doing, for example, with GPs, and they've emulated. So, if I just give an example, my daughter, Dr. Helen Leach, recently qualified as a GP. We got the care of the military into the curriculum for all GPs nationally, so that as Helen qualified as a GP, she will have needed to have known about, high blood pressure or antenatal care, as part of being a doctor and a general practitioner. We've also got that deliberately into the curriculum for all GPs. So actually, GPs should be have a that base understanding. So they've been our international partners have been very interested, and actually the Australians have now similarly managed to put care of the military community into their equivalent curriculum for general practitioners who qualify in Australia. So, we talk regularly with our international partners because there's no monopoly of ideas, and we try and take ideas from them just as they take ideas from us.
The human connection is so vital and so important, but I can already see folks beginning to think, oh, maybe artificial intelligence and chat GPTs can actually help with respect to this. Is it something from your own perspective, Jonathan, that actually this cannot be replaced by machine technology? You do need to actually have that human point of contact.
It depends, actually. There is evidence that, for example, some of the PTSD, if you've got less complicated PTSD, there is evidence, and around things like depression, that some of the online therapies can actually be really helpful. So I wouldn't discount it. But on the other side, having that human side and trust with your health professional, I don't think will ever go. But I think that certainly, you know, there is evidence that some of these therapies can be of value online. And the NHS.UK website, for example, does include some of those. But certainly, if you've got more complicated, you need more support, actually having that human touch, I suspect, will always be there. I can't see that that would go. We're just as we are as humans.
And a reminder, where can people actually go to access details regarding OpCourage?
Yeah, so the easiest way is take your Google or whichever is your favourite search engine and just put in OpCourage. I looked this morning in Google, it came up first. If you want to go direct, it would be all the W's, nhs.uk/OpCourage. And those website and associated pages have all the details of OpCourage, which is the mental health programme. It has details of OpRestore, how you can access that, which would be through your GP. It's also got a lot of other support for, you know, and detail about, for example, GP accreditation, as I've described. So that's where we would go first. And then a lot of military charities have all these details as well.
Dr. Jonathan Leach, OBE, NHS England Associate Medical Director for Armed Forces Veterans Health. Trips off the tongue so easily. Many thanks indeed. Take care and all the very best.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.